What is today? It's December 13th, meeting of the Finance Committee. We have a forum, finally. Shouldn't have just joined. Do we have any public comment? Anybody in chambers? They're all going to comment eventually tonight, but obviously none. Anybody on Zoom? I don't see any hands. Okay, move on. Item three, the state budget update. Mr. Helm.
So we're getting the bad news out of the way, Mr. Chairman, first, before we get to the deep dive series and the grants. I know there's been a lot of talk, but just for everybody's edification, probably seen a lot of things in the press about budgets and Beacon Hill. The good news is the governor just did sign out the FY23 supplemental budget, which does include a couple of key things that relate to Franklin. Number one, it does authorize the $250 million. It's been hubbubbed about in the press a lot for the emergency shelter crisis, which is good because the state was running out of money on it. So that's really good news. And just really quickly, fortunately, the local town is still not expending any local dollars on this issue other than staff time. We have a coalition that's been working exceptionally well together. As I've reported every couple weeks, I think the superintendent has as well, the school committee, things are moving along well. I will say, however, is the schools have not received a penny from the state yet. We know the money has been authorized, but they're making us apply for it, and the schools have applied for their respective portion. So this is one of those, Mr. Chairman, that we're probably going to be going months right up until the end of June trying to make sure that every dollar that we've spent in the schools is being accurately compensated back from the state. We've heard all the electeds on camera, on TV. They've all committed they're going to pay every penny. But people have asked me these questions a lot, so I just felt like it was better to be open and transparent about it. But again, the schools have done a great job on this entire endeavor. I said that numerous times. And the amount of incredible energy and passion that they put into it has been incredible. We have applied for the money, and we would be hopeful that the dollars would start coming in soon. But I get asked that question at least once or twice a week. So, and the second piece that's in the supplemental budget, and I'm sure there'll be more guidance coming from the state. If you recall, last year we were dealing with the out-of-district placement costs, the 14%. The legislation does have $75 million. For eligible school districts to try to help offset some of those costs. Not sure yet exactly what that all means. It was just in the final bill from a week and a half ago, but I'm sure the state education office will be sending out more as time goes on. But the town sent a letter to the representatives, the schools sent a letter to the representatives, we've all participated through our associations. So it's nice to see that a lot of our efforts from the local level have finally come in to the state. So this is the good news. It's the bad one is the article that Amy and I got a couple last week. Tax collections not keeping pace as state spending soars. Governor Healey announced today that she is not going to make any quote unquote 9C cuts, which is gubernatorial authority. It's called 9C. It's a statutory reference. It's a kind of colloquial term. She announced today that she is not ready to make any cuts to the budget in the current fiscal year, which is excellent news. But obviously, the faces on these two gentlemen here that work for the state don't look happy. And they just had a consensus revenue hearing, which the legislature and the administration do by statute every December. And it doesn't look good heading into next year. That being said, Amy and I have both been through a lot of budget crises in our lives, and usually the one thing that is untouchable is local aid. So where that is the overwhelming amount, if not a total amount of money that we get from the state through Chapter 70 and local aid, That's always the largest priority, and so we wouldn't still hopefully see any cuts. But I think as you can see, the economy's still up and down a little bit, and I think these tax collections and these numbers kind of illustrate that. So I just wanted to give the committee a quick update on that as we head into our own budget process, which is already kind of kicked off, but we'll be getting departments together in January and February. And as I said before, early March, we'll have a first budget model out, which will hopefully reflect the state of the state, if you will. So just wanted to give everybody an update. Thank you very much.
I have one question. Mm-hmm. It's kind of related, not to that. I've struck up a relationship with a member of the Finance Committee in Milford. He initiated it a while back, and we chat once in a while. In one of the conversations recently, he dropped the number. I said, well, at least we get, and I could be a little off, $29 million plus or minus from the state of the schools, round number.
Yeah, that's all right. That's pretty close, yeah.
Milford gets $45
million. Yeah.
What's the difference? And I know,
is everybody ready for the Chapter 70 deep dive tutorial? No,
well,
It's very simple. Chapter 70 is based on what's called an aggregate wealth model, okay? And this was done in 2006 to make an amendment to the 1993 Chapter 70 law. And it's based off your property value and your median income. And so ultimately, the lowest, if you think of the community, I'm just guessing it might be like Holyoke or a community like that, that has some of the lowest property values, probably Springfield. In addition to the low median income, they get the highest percentage of their school budget paid for. So in other words, wealthier communities generally receive less in Chapter 70. That was only kind of doubled down on in the Student Opportunity Act bill in 2019. And Senator Spilka and Rep. Roy, I think, were all very clear during those times that the infusion of money through the Student Opportunity Act was not geared towards helping towns like us. It was geared towards dealing with underperforming school districts, Brockton's, Wareham's, Winchendon's, rural communities out in the western part of the state. So my guess is, without looking all the numbers, just a real quick high-level hit, my guess is that Milford's property values and median income are probably lower than Franklin's, and therefore they see a higher share of that. The other piece I would add in, I don't know the numbers, so I'm just taking a guess. I think the charter school in Franklin, I think, added Milford in their redistricting in the mid-2015 timeframe. So I don't know the charter school numbers, but I'm guessing that Franklin probably also sends a far greater amount of students to the charter school than Milford does. Just a couple of guesses.
Okay. It just, when you drop that number, it kind of, you know, it kind of explodes.
We're a more affluent community than what people want to admit. And second on this, and I know all of you have heard the spiel from me a million times, I know Natalie and George you have, I mean, this is part of the systemic financial problem that we've had here, which is as the town has gotten wealthier in the last 15 years, our tax levy has not kept up with that. And therefore, our state aid has leveled off or kind of slightly, it's basically plateaued. Whereas, Mr. Chairman, when you were, you know, 30, 40 years ago, Franklin was getting more state aid than anyone else because the property values here were low. It was a, you know, lower middle class to middle class community from an income perspective. And, oh, by the way, the town was building 200 single family homes a year for 20 years. So you had a lot of kids. And so all that basically led to a huge spike in Chapter 70 money. And in addition, in 2006, when the aggregate wealth model came in, it started to plummet down, but that was also when the declining enrollment happened. So I don't know Milford's enrollment numbers, but that might be another factor. They may be seeing a spike in...
They're slightly less, I believe.
Like, yeah, it's not just the overall number, right? It also looks at what you would look at the trajectory of where their population has been the last 10 years, where ours has leveled off, and as we've talked about at these meetings, has actually declined the last couple of years, including the declining enrollment. So you know, without looking at Milford's numbers really closely, those are just some indicative guesses.
It just was a, whoa, what's that all about?
Hopefully some of my educated guesses are correct, but now you know.
Anything else, guys? Future agenda items, guys? Tell you what, if you do, email them to me and I'll forward to Jamie. We've got to start repeating people now, because we've been through, I think we've had Mike once before. I don't remember. But everybody else has been in. I'd kind of like to dovetail when, so people aren't doing crazy amount of work. When the council gets a presentation, kind of dovetail with us, either before or after.
Sure. Yeah, sure. I mean, I think going into next fiscal year, I would just argue that the big five or six need to make sure people know where their money's going. I mean, I think we've been through the permitting folks. You know, what you see is what you get. We have two planners, right? Like, there's not really a lot to analyze, but I think Mike's budget, DPW, police, fire, and schools are really the large. I mean, that's the overwhelmingly size of the budget. So I think, here we have Mike tonight, but I think we've heard a lot from public safety. Probably want to see maybe the schools again.
I was going to say they're here tonight, I suppose.
Right, and probably public works at some point. Brutus is always a lot more entertaining than me or anybody else. And then, Mr. Chairman, on the budget hearings, there's the calendar for 2024. I would note that due to some scheduling conflicts, and I just wanted to get the committee's view on this. I know George and Natalie talked about this before. I have four dates for the budget hearings on here. I know we don't need them, but before I made any decisions, I wanted to talk to you guys about whether you wanted to make those dates permanent tonight. And then for the schools, they have a couple of large scheduling conflicts that week, and they were wondering if maybe the school department budget review could be the week before or even the week after, and if people were available. So I have the traditional 4 days down there. I mean, I still think we should do the general government one day, but it's really, do you want to do police, fire, and DPW all in one night again?
Yeah, I think it was fine. So it would be general, and then schools would be the following week.
So it'd be three, yeah, we just have to kind of pick a date the following week if folks were around in May. So that would be the week of the 13th. There's a school committee meeting the night of the 14th. I don't know if that night is a candidate for the finance committee hearing on the school budget, if you need to have a school committee meeting, or we could do Monday the 13th or even Wednesday the 15th and do the school budget that night. But it's really up to all your calendars. Yeah.
Mine's open.
That's the easy part.
Yeah. You want to do Wednesday the 15th?
Sounds good.
So would we do the 6th, 7th, 8th, 15th, and then no 8th, 9th?
You would do either you would do the 6th and the 8th.
Okay.
So the 6th would be general government, the 8th would be public safety and DPW, and then the 15th would be the schools. And final recommendation. Because we'll do the final recommendation after. Does that work for everybody?
It does now.
I'll send out a revised calendar, Mr. Chairman, to everything. Is that good with you guys on the 15th?
Yes.
Does that work, Bob?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
You can
thank
do it. Okay, great. Yep. Right. So everybody's happy.
For a moment.
I'll send a revised calendar out, Mr. Chairman, to the group with the dates for next year. But everything else, I think, is pretty straightforward.
Right. So the future.
6th, 8th, and 18th.
Well, shall we deep dive into
our public properties?
Yeah. Just really quickly, Mr. Chairman, I added in, just so everybody's clear, you know, a lot has gone on in facilities in the last several years. I didn't have time to write a big memo or anything, but I just added in some, the items that are listed here are not meant to be one by one. We have to discuss each one of them. I just put it there as a list of information and things that have been going on that relate to facilities. And as you can see, the first item I added in there was the budget. The Finance Committee had asked for a list of town buildings and square footage. And so I just added in some other stuff that was recently important that relates to facilities. As the schools know, we have 1.3 million square feet of space the town manages. And 1 million of that space is school facilities. So the overwhelming majority of the space we manage is facilities. If you look into the budget, you'll see a breakdown in the expenses. You know, Mike has a about an $8.5 million budget. And you know, really, when you look at 3.3 million in salaries for the custodians, the trades guys, the staff, then you got $2 million for electricity. You know, you have another $1 million in there for propane, gas, more than that, probably $1.5 million for propane, gas. You know, I think what you see here in his budget, and go through it every year, is the overwhelming majority of Mike's budget are supplies, contractors to fix things, and really it's just basically public, it's just basically utilities. It's lights, gas, plumbing, electricals, mechanicals. It's all broken out line item by line item. Mr. Chairman, as you remember, we certainly are more than happy to provide people with the, I think it's about 100 pages, Mike, where we have every account and every meter in every building laid out. But several years ago, people said it's too much, don't include it, because ultimately all that report just goes into what you see here as a summary for what the costs are for utilities. I think, Mr. Chairman, if you have any questions, I think on the budget or the facilities we own and manage, and any questions on that, I think it'd be wise to just kind of tackle those first, and then maybe after those questions are answered, maybe get into the capital plan and some of the capital items afterwards. And Mike's right up here in the front. He's got all his, looks like he's got those documents ready to go. And so folks can ask him whatever they want.
I have a couple of just housekeeping questions on the capital improvement plan. Is that where we are now, on the plan or on the budget? What are we?
I think on the, just do the budget and the footprint of facilities first, just so we can kind of keep it organized. And the capital plan, I think, you know, once all those questions are answered about the operating budget, maybe we can tackle the capital plan after that.
Okay. Nice questions on.
I have one on the listing.
On the town on building?
Just on all the different pieces of property.
That's fine.
They're not all buildings.
Right.
Is there a rhyme or reason to the list besides this is what we own?
Could you just be more specific?
Like, sure.
What are you talking about?
We're talking
about like gazebos and playgrounds or what?
What? You've got antennas up here, you've got tanks up here.
Yeah.
Stations, wells.
Yeah. So the antennas Mike manages. We added on the bottom of all the pump stations and wells just to illustrate, like, Mike does not manage those. Those are all in the DPW budget. But they're also facilities that oftentimes we collaborate with the DPW to work on this stuff, whether it's green communities, mechanicals, or other things. So while he doesn't technically manage them in his budget, we are still working with the DPW to consult on those things. I think that's probably the best way to say it, right, Mike? You don't manage them, but when they ask us for advice or procurement or other things, we work with them on all of these issues as well.
one quick question. The list of two solar farms, do we don't own those, do we? We have a solar farm.
We manage the net metering. We manage the net metering credits for the solar farms.
Oh, so the management is not physical management, it's management of money coming in, basically?
So we, on Upper Union, so in late 2011 and early 2012, we negotiated and signed a contract with Kearsarge Energy at the point. They were the people building it. And we take the entire output of that 8-meg solar farm on Upper Union and pay. And so when you do that, they put credits on your bills based on a thing they call a Schedule Z that just distributes. There's two Schedule Zs, one for each. It's actually technically two solar farms, but grid won't let you build a solar farm over 5 meg. So we credit those to our bills, to DPW bills, and then we pay the owner of the solar farm, which has changed four times since 2011. $0.90 on a dollar for every dollar that they credit to our bills.
So they pay us, then we pay them back 90%? Is that what I heard?
They credit it to the, so the solar farm has a meter, just like all of our buildings have meters, and your house has a meter. And based on a percentage of what that solar farm generates, we get a credit to our bill. Aside from that, we provide the bills, which for them are, it's what it generates. And then we receive a bill from the owner for 90 cents on a dollar for what they credited to our bills. So it's more of a transaction based on a law, because a power purchase agreement is an agreement where power goes into the grid when it's operating, and we take it out of the grid, and it's regardless of, you know, location and time when we take it out.
Can you give an example of how this works? Like, say, $100?
Yep. So if the solar farm generates, because it's also metered at the residential rate.
Okay.
So it's metered at the highest rate that National Grid charges per kilowatt, which changes twice a year, as you know, when your bill goes up, went up in November. So if the solar farm generates $100, we put 30 on the high school and 20 on Horace Mann and Keller Sullivan and the big schools, and less on little buildings. DPW buildings get certain amounts, and it all adds up. So they generate $100 worth of energy. And then afterwards, we give them that bill for $100. And
you give who?
We just send them the bill, because it's a negative bill. They just,
right.
National Grid requires that the town that's purchasing the energy, the bill be in their name.
Okay.
So it's in the town of Franklin's name, even though we don't own it.
Okay.
We don't pretend to own it.
No, it's God.
Yeah, but.
Energy is a extraordinarily complicated topic when you're talking about this type of stuff. And, you know, like, but that money that comes to us, then we, just an example, we invest in LED lights in every building, every school. So there's a difficult method to the madness on how that all works, right, Mike?
It does. And the solar farm makes money. It typically makes, because it's, I don't know if I'm going to get too deep in this, but
yeah, I know.
It, because of what it's at the residential rate, which might be 20 cents, just philosophically,
yeah.
Even number, Well, we bid out our electricity, and we're only paying 10 or 12 cents.
Okay.
So on that scale, it operates like a much larger solar farm, because the money we're getting off of it is the money of, instead of an 8-meg solar farm, a 12 or 13-meg solar farm. And just that just has to do with the difference in kilowatt-hour rates that we pay out. But we take in and pay them 90% of the $100 that it has credited to our bills. Because that was the deal we struck with them back in 2011 and 2012.
So in effect, we're getting a 10% reduction in electric costs?
Correct.
Across, bad way to put it, but across the board?
Yep.
So if the bill for this building should be $1,000, it's 900.
Yep.
Is that too simple?
No, that's probably about as deep as you want to go without getting into a cave that you can't get out of. I just would also note, purchasing power agreements, the laws have changed over the last 12 or 13 years. We have a consultant, Doug, that's in Mike's budget that helps us guide on electricity, global dynamics and what to do. This requires a lot of behind the scenes work that Mike and myself and the town attorney and even sometimes special counsel have to tap into. And the net metering credits from an administrative standpoint, both for the finance department as well as Mike's staff, these are the large and little things we do on a day in day out basis that occupy a lot of our time at different points in the year, Mike. And I just have to emphasize from a staff perspective, you know, we spend an inordinate amount of time on a lot of these issues. We follow the legislature on this stuff. We follow the appellate tax board. I mean, there's decisions. We work with the board of assessors on these things to help manage this, right? And I just have to throw that in there because it is a tremendous amount of work and effort on the staff's time, the board of assessors, the assessor's staff. It's a big team effort. We think we do a great job, but it is one of those things that I think sometimes when you see the management of, we think of just facilities as trying to get rid of mold at Remington Jefferson or fix a roof or fix the senior center or whatever, but really there's a lot of other things that we do as well, and that's why these deep dive series are really kind of cool, even if some of the topics can get a little boring.
One quick follow-up?
Sure.
The 90-10 ratio that we get, have you ever seen how it compares to others in the industry or standard?
Today it's way lower than that. You'd never get a contract at 90%. But in 2011 and 2012, so when they were, because Grid wants more solar farms, they have, I was talking to Bob Moran from National Grid on Friday, and there's only about half the solar in Massachusetts that they need to get to meet their goal. And we're obviously running out of land at some level. Because like the one on Upper Union, that's a big solar farm. That takes a lot of space. So today you're lucky to get 5% if you go in with a company. But people were really hungry, and when they brought this to us, they were willing to give, 10%. The solar farm had most recently changed hands, and the owner, which has been tangentially a partial owner for a while, had broached the subject with us of possibly, so it's a 20-year contract, and extending it for another 10 years and giving us another 5%. But in doing that, he would also go up there and change out all the panels, because in 10 years, panels have gone from 30 watts to 400 watts for the same size panel. So
technology's increased.
But...
It's exponential.
And not in the, it's not really as much the 90-10. The 90-10 is a good thing, but up in, just with the 90-10 and what we were doing, up until last November, it generated about $400,000 of excess revenue for the town. The National Grid...
If you change up the panels, it could be extremely high, yeah.
And so when we have $400,000 in extra, I participate in doing energy projects with National Grid and our energy expediter. And we basically have spent that $400,000 a year doing LED lighting. LED lighting is 100% in every town building, every school building. There's transformers that take the higher voltage services to the big complexes in the high school, and small transformers that convert it to 120 for plug loads. And we replaced all the transformers in all three big complexes because they only technically waste 20% of the energy that a 20-year-old transformer would waste. So right now we're working on a project over at the high school that we're doing one field, but it's dropping the wattage of the lamps to light the field from a 1500 watt metal halide light to an 800 watt LED fixture. So, and lately we found some things that I thought we had done pretty much everything that was low hanging fruit, and we had a meeting with Colin, is the food service director for Franklin Schools, and some of his suppliers. And we actually found that walk-in freezers, dishwashers, that this company is pricing now, but at Keller Sullivan, the dishwasher that was installed in that building in late 01, and they did a energy savings on it. Right now it costs us about $16,000 plus to run that dishwasher between electric and water. And if we change it out, it'll cost $1,500 a year. And the walk-ins are similar. There's some issues with the two walk-ins, and the walk-ins at Horace Mann and the walk-ins at Keller Sullivan. And those, because of the insulation deteriorating over time, those could have similar savings. So when you look across all of Franklin, across the board, all these big dishwashers that are in the complexes that have been open, Remington Jefferson was 96, Keller Sullivan was 02, Horace Mann was 04. We just might have found something that has incredible savings. And National Grid, basically everything we do, from the lighting to every project, their incentives kick in about 30% of the entire project cost.
So the savings, how do we pay for the new dishwashers? Is that a capital item, or is it just
So what we've been doing is we do something called OBR, which is on-bill repayment. So we set up we apply for a project. We have an energy expediter, so I work with them. We apply for the project.
Apply to
National Grid.
Okay.
And they've done energy saving calculations like the one I just mentioned that for the seller of like dishwashers and freezers and walk-ins and stuff. You apply to National Grid with the energy savings. They come back to you with an incentive for you, because they're always paying incentives for us, for any customer to reduce their electric usage. And then we sign up for on-bill repayment.
Sign up for what? Say that again?
It's on-bill repayment.
Okay, so that they bill it on the monthly bill, which is reduced 10% because...
Which is reduced 10% plus those enormous credits on our bills because over the last year, when electricity went up, the amount of credits on our bill went up. So we have...
And do we know what the repayment plan for that type of a project is? For example, if it costs $30,000 for the new dishwasher and we're getting a $6,000 savings, it's a roughly 5-year payback.
But with the credits on our bills, we just usually pay them off right after we finish the project. It just gets credited to our bill. Right now, our Franklin High School bill has about $290,000 in credits on it because of the solar farm.
Okay, one other question. We have lots of flat space here, high school, all of them. Is that, I guess the word is in play to be used for solar and thus generate, or is it? I suspect there may be building issues. I'm sure the high school may have been built to support them.
They were.
So our issue right now, because so we own the entire output of that one, and we own $100,000 a year of a newer one they just opened up a year and a half ago over in Bellingham. It's also developed by Kearsarge. But right now, we're getting too many credits. We don't need more solar. We've already got a deal that's gonna last us another 10 years. And then we're just getting even beyond what we use. And then you have to figure out a way to either sell it, because National Grid will not just cut us a check, even if we have, $800,000 in credits. You have to find a way to use it. And we've been using it for all these years, and that's why Franklin is actually that energy efficient. Even when we built the building, like Franklin High, they kicked in $550,000 on that in just incentives. But if we add more solar, we're at max right now. I did look at adding
some credits.
Yeah, but we do not live long enough to spend it.
Well, yeah. Unless we come up with projects that we can use the credits for.
Yeah, but it's going to be winter.
Well, yeah. Exactly. That's what I'm getting at.
In every project we do, we become more energy efficient, use less energy.
Making
the credits higher.
It's a vicious cycle.
Speaking of that, how do you control the lights at the tennis court at the high school?
They're on
by at 11 o'clock at night.
They're supposed to, I think, well, I don't personally control them.
I think Ryan
schedules them, yeah. And he keeps them on. I believe he keeps them on until 9 o'clock at night.
Unless something's going on.
Unless... Yeah, but I think, so everything, all our exterior lighting is controlled through a program that the athletic director and Ryan both use at all our field locations, Beaver.
Well, we've cast a lot of sunshine on that, haven't we?
I just want to point out, Heather has a question online. Heather Dan Susi, I think she's got her hand raised.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Heather.
Hi, sorry about that. Thank you, Jamie, for seeing my hand raised. So all of this is very interesting, and I know we're getting a little bit granular there, but one of the questions I was, on a larger scale, I know on the agenda it says something about the school facility building subcommittee. I believe there's a master facilities committee or something to that effect, and is that something where that committee or that group is looking at these cost savings? Because I noticed the budget year over year increases, and so what is your department's plan to maybe either request less money in the budget this year or find some other cost savings methods?
The reason my budget went up so much last year was based on the change in energy prices. So last year, we had come up with, we ended a 4-year contract that ran out for our electric supply. And we bid it out a couple times. We look at it, we get tests, and we ended up signing a new 4-year contract for, we'd been at 10 cents, we went up to 14 cents, which is actually a sizable jump in, but still way below what everybody else out there was paying. And to do that, we track it for a long time. And also, the global price of natural gas is really in flux right now. If you have natural gas in your house, you're paying a lot more for it today than you were prior to the war starting up with Russia and Ukraine. And so that has pushed the prices higher. We did get a pretty good price on gas, although we only signed a 2-year contract for natural gas because we believe that if some of this unrest stops in the world, natural gas will plummet again. But New England has some of the highest prices. Go ahead.
So I guess all of that makes sense. Those are really uncontrollable costs at our level. So what are the other things that your department is doing for things that they maybe can control? So like that refrigerator example that you had, is there any other initiatives being done to make it so that your budget is a little less?
The other reason my budget, well, what I mentioned was, I mean, there's walk-in freezers at all our large buildings. There is a walk-in, or there's walk-in freezers at Parmenter and Kennedy too, but they're very small. But those type of savings, like the field lights, the walk-in refrigerators, the dishwashers at the three big complexes would be something that we'd be concentrating on over the next couple of years to change all those out. Motors have gotten so much more efficient. But the other thing that's, you know, driving the high cost of the budget is construction is pretty much double what it used to be. And we're out there buying motors and drives and things that are just
strategically, what is, I mean, knowing that those costs rising and what have you are truly out of our control in some sense of the word, strategically, what is your department doing to ensure that budget either, you know, stays the same or decreases in some way, knowing that we have a bit of a shortfall?
Jamie?
Yeah, through Mr. Chairman. Heather, it's a phenomenal question. We could ask that of every department.
I wouldn't want to.
Yeah, I know. And you're going to get a very common answer, which is there really is not a lot that you can honestly do strategically to fix things like plumbing supplies. If you want to know the honest truth, you need a global, like you need a global economic meltdown to really bring costs back down. If you look through Mike's budget,
plumbing supplies and all that.
Right. So I was going to get to that in a second. So if you look through Mike's budget, you go electricity, natural gas, propane, water, sewer, stormwater, building maintenance, equipment maintenance, HVAC, plumbing, electrical, doors, windows, roofs, pest control, equipment, leasing, custodial services, disposal services. So like a good example would be recently the composting initiative at all the schools, right? So there's a strategic initiative that's doing something that might be able to equalize out the price a little bit with the DPW in terms of trash control, in terms of refuse. But we would go out to bid maybe on a very regular schedule on custodial supplies, okay? So we can put out annual procurements on things. We can make sure we're getting the most competitive bid prices. I'm just letting you know, though, we do all that all the time as part of our regular course of just what we do as a business. But Brutus's budget at DPW and the facilities budget are two budgets you just simply don't really have a lot of control over what to do. And I would just close out by saying, if you look back at the last several years, particularly the pandemic year, when Mike's budget is, the facilities budget is usually one of the budgets that we target to cut, okay, when there's revenue drops. So next year, right, if there's some sort of economic problem based on the state budget we were just talking about and revenues are gonna come in less, Mike will probably see less of an increase, okay? But last year, in fact, the last two fiscal years, for example, Mike's ran out of money to solve problems, like if a water bubbler breaks or whatever. And so we've basically said to departments in like April, no more fixing of anything. We can't fix them. Mike is out of money. And I say that to you because, you know, the question comes up of like, what are you strategically doing? We do all the right things structurally, but if you look at Mike's budget, there's very, very little that is within our unilateral control to somehow fix something. And even in the personnel line item, you know, you have not just collective bargaining, but you have cost increases related to staff. And I think one of the things you've seen in the budget the last couple of years is obviously inflation, you know, has really substantially hit Mike's budget very hard. I think last year, this year alone, was over $1 million increase just due to electricity, natural gas, water, sewer, stormwater, and all the other increases. So next year, the council will likely have to consider a modest stormwater increase or a, you know, some sort of water rate increase to deal with capital projects with the water tanks. And then Mike's budget as a result is gonna go up by however that rate is. So those are very challenging things to singularly control. Thank you.
I just wanted to say thank you, Jamie, for explaining that. I think that it's great for you to explain that because many, many people don't understand how all of this works. And it's great to know real goings on of how numbers come about. Yeah. So thank you.
You bet. Thanks, Heather.
Can I just ask a quick question related to the budget and the square footage? I'm just curious, do the buildings take their, you know, does their spend relate almost directly back to the size of their building? You know, if the school's 25% of the allocated square footage in town, are they roughly 25% of the spend? You know, is there one building that's actually getting a disproportionate amount of spend based on the size? You know, if a 3,500 square foot building is taking a couple $100,000, that would make no sense. I'm just curious, do they mostly line up within their allocated space in the town, or does one building actually consume more than they probably should for their size?
So Remington Jefferson, Horace Mann, and Keller Sullivan use a large, much larger amount of energy to heat them. And that's mainly because when they were built, insulation technology hadn't really changed yet. And so it costs a couple $100,000 in gas to heat each of those complexes, and each of them are roughly 200,000 square feet. But the high school is actually, high school's 304,000 square feet. And on a heating, strictly gas heating, it is by far the most efficient. It's about 70,000 a year to actually heat it because of the heating system and the consequent insulation. The walls of those other schools don't really have, so Franklin High School, if you're building a commercial building today, you put up the shell and then you put 4 inches of a foam board that's got a very high R factor to it, cover the whole outside of it, then you use a wind and vapor barrier on the outside of that and seal it up. And it was interesting when we built Franklin High, usually we're walking around in these buildings in the middle of the winter when we're building them with Tempe freezing to death. And when you went into Franklin High with just a few Tempe heaters, you had to take your coat off in the middle of the winter. It's by far the most efficient, but in the early 2000s and the 90s, no insulation. Some insulation got put in the walls, 6 inches of fiberglass insulation, which is by such a small amount of insulation. I mean, we're talking the exterior walls of the high school are an R40, and those other complexes would be an R19, to literally more than, you know, double.
Just to layer on that, I would hope that that type of information would be considered in any type of, I know this went nowhere, but the whole school, like, let's close one and let's move things around. I feel like a lot of times emotional factors come into there of which one we wouldn't want to close down because, you know, that's my beloved school, it's close to this one. But I would hope that those economic factors of who's the most efficient or who could become the most efficient would get factored in.
Well, if you just took this and you put a column in that showed the percentage of space as opposed, you know, compared to the total, and then the spend compared to the total spend, I mean, you'd obviously see the buildings that were the least efficient, right? And it would be eye-opening to some people that they
It's hard to argue that when it's numbers.
It's really hard to argue, yeah.
I agree.
Okay. Anything else? List of town-owned buildings, which is the spreadsheet?
Yes.
Yeah. No, that's the capital improvement.
Yeah, this is the town-owned buildings.
Okay. Do we have any other questions or whatever? The Kessel Booth study?
Through the chair, again, I just added those in. I mean, the school department is conducting, I think as Natalie just pointed out, a comprehensive facilities analysis. And, you know, we did the 2020 study on the existing conditions of the school facilities. These are all just referential materials. If there's no questions, nobody has to ask it. They're just there referentially. I do know that the schools and I think the town have talked about this quite a bit over the last few years. But you know, when you're talking facilities, deep dives, these are big items, right? And I think to Lauren and Natalie's points a minute ago, it's you know, there's cost metrics that go into this. I did a slide, I think whenever I did some presentation to the Joint Budget Subcommittee on fixed costs, and I think this is something. You know, Mike and I talk about a lot. It's great to hear FinCom members also talk about it. Mike's budget is ultimately a casualty of this, and I think it relates to last year's budget debate. You know, I said it clearly, I'll say it again, and I'll probably say it more times, but, you know, I think this is the importance of the collaboration between the school committee, the school department, the town council, and the town departments. We're not isolated from each other. We're married for life. And, you know, what decisions they make about space per square foot affects the fixed costs of what we have to spend. So when last year you get whacked for $1.2 million in inflationary increases, and people say to me, why isn't everybody else getting more money? You know, I can't make it any more clearer. It's just sometimes I feel like I'm Al Gore with the inconvenient truth. Like that this stuff costs a lot of money. And especially in an era of inflation, which we haven't seen in the United States anywhere near this for 40 years, many people, including myself, never managed communities up until this is the new reality. So, you know, we went through those exercises. I think they're important data points. I know the schools are going through another process now. And so they're referentially there. And if you notice, I did put the capital plan at the end of these lists, which I think Lauren just kind of brought up too, which is about efficiencies. I think there's also some challenging items on here. If you look at the capital plan, relating to investments that you have to make into buildings. So, you know, I know it's a microscopic print, but if you look at items on here, you have the Davis Thayer roofing replacement in a couple of years. That's an issue for the council to deal with in terms of what they're going to finally do with the Davis Thayer property. But if you look on here elsewhere, Mike's added on some estimates, and some of these are pretty accurate for the current years. But we highlighted out there, you know, at some point, the town is going to have to invest tens of millions of dollars in the renovation of Remington Jefferson, also Parmenter, you know, Kennedy, dealing with the modulars and a lot of the other improvements. Parmenter and Kennedy are very old buildings. And the town's eventually got to make some sort of decision about how we're going to transition either with those facilities, without them, and on to whatever else for what the future educational needs of children in the future are. I think one of the hardest things that we deal with today is exactly what Natalie pointed out. There's a lot of emotional attachment to these facilities, and for good reason. There are other options, but you know, when you look at some of these numbers in one-time costs, one thing I want to point out to Heather really quickly was, I forgot to mention about her question, which was excellent. We just went through, Heather, the net metering credits. And somebody asked, well, Mike, how'd you pay for the dishwasher replacement? Oh, it was on the credits, it was credited to the bill. Let's say we weren't doing that solar farm project. This capital plan would have be twice as long, because it would have every refrigerator, oven, dishwasher, all these other items. So when the schools come to us, or the DPW or police say, oh, we need $50,000 for curriculum or tasers or a new protective gear at the fire department or a new cruiser or car, we wouldn't be able to buy those if we didn't do what Mike's doing with net metering credits, because we'd have to spend $50,000 or whatever, I'm making up the number, $50,000 on a dishwashing system, right? So when we talk about strategic ideas, what we do with solar actually helps us relieve additional cost requests for capital items. And you know, when you're talking about dishwashers and freezers and all these other things that are energy efficient items, that's one thing how we've been able to upgrade a lot of the facilities over the years at schools. Those items aren't on this list, and most of the items on this list are you know, usually mechanical or structural related costs. And in the case of Remington Jefferson, for example, you know, we would try to renovate the school to make it as energy efficient as possible. I think one of the challenges when you ask that question, Lauren, what's the more inefficient area? It's actually one of the more modern schools. Parmenter is the oldest building, but Keller Sullivan may not be the most efficient building. So, you know, I think you're right. You have to look at all that cost per square footage, but you could end up pouring more millions and millions of more dollars into an older building than even in a less efficient building, right? So these are tough decisions, right? Every company in America goes through. And so we've lined out here for about a 10-year or so plan. This is not perfect. Things will change. Other things will come up over the future, but this gives you at least a snapshot into what, you know, we're looking out into the future of what the kind of cost drivers are going to be from a capital plan perspective.
Might be interesting. I took that spreadsheet and assigned, and I know this is heresy, but schools for spending versus town spending. I'm sorry, but strangely enough, it is equal.
Yeah.
Equal over the next, whatever this is, 10 years. The town total is 61 million.
It's because of the police station.
The school total is 63.
Huh? It's because of the police station.
Yeah.
And the rent.
Absolutely. In the police station is the big number at 50 grand. Thereabouts.
And to keep in mind, so I've been here since 98. I finished Keller Sullivan in 02, I finished Horace Mann in 04. And so those buildings are in, Remington Jefferson was built 2 years prior to me coming here. But what you have right now is, you have a building that's, you know, approaching in a few years, 30 years old. It needs a new heating system, it needs a new fire alarm system, and it needs a new roof. And those are things that wear out. And so you have that same issue in all three complexes. And you could spend, the pavement at Remington is in the worst shape. You could drop $8 million easily into each of those complexes, but that would buy you another 20, 25 years with much more efficient equipment. I mean, the only problem at the moment is, I mean, everybody's pushing you to go electric, but in all honesty, I'm a mechanical engineer and I go to lots of stuff, but you can do something with a house or you can do something with a new building, but you can't really retrofit one of these big buildings with unit ventilators in every room easily. Going electric is by far your worst option, and every engineer will admit it to you that the police station's a different story. When you're starting new, and it's not a huge building, it's expected to be in the 30,000 square feet. That's reasonably easy to do, but to go in, it's just like your house. If you have baseboard heat, there is no more efficient way than to burn gas and heat your house. And there's nothing made that's electric that will cause you to spend $50,000-$60,000 to turn it electric and probably pay way more in electricity than you would in natural gas. And that's kind of the unfortunate thing, is everybody saying, oh yeah, do this. But it is not feasible, practical. So just put in the most efficient system. We put a new heating system in this building last fall. And but it's super efficient compared to what was in here. And I mean, the high school has modular boilers similar to what's in a lot of our town buildings that were built. But you also got to look at the most recent group of town buildings we built, like the DPW, the fire station, the senior center. I mean, those are all 15 years old. So those are going to need money too. Because by the time those are hitting 20, the heating systems are in rough shape. I don't think the roofs will still last a long time. Some of our roofs will last for years longer. But the heating systems and the fire alarm systems are what's going to be. And when that stuff starts breaking, I tend to spend fortunes fixing it. So there's a certain time. I mean, at Kennedy, we replaced the entire heating system, including all the unit ventilators, 11 years ago, and that actually runs really efficiently. It's got high efficiency condensing boilers in it, and that's really the thing you would do today. And then at some point they'll figure out how to efficiently heat a hot water loop with electricity, but they just haven't invented that yet.
Can I ask one more question, just because I'm new, and I don't know if this is a loaded question, but why do we need a new police station for $50 million when it was only built in 1991? I'm just curious. Is it wildly inefficient or too small for our needs? Or, you know, I'm just curious.
Sure. It's incredibly too small for the needs.
Okay.
It was built improperly in a wetland. There's no place to expand. It looks tremendously nice from the outside with a nice cut lawn and stuff. When you go inside, it's just incredibly inefficient building. And ultimately, the town just grew and the department has grown far beyond what the needs are. It's really just at that time where you really need, you know, I mean, I could go into a lot of details.
Fine. And will that building be repurposed for anything?
It's a great question. Yes, for something. what I think is a huge question.
Yeah.
It has a lot of weird things in it that won't, like cells and...
There's a very unique and niche market that builds public safety facilities, as you can imagine, because of the requirements about sally ports and where you contain, you know, confiscated items and how you have to have 24/7 surveillance on somebody in the cell. I mean, I could, you know, there's like, you know, 100 or 200 of those types of things that, you know, that would need to be, that need to be upgraded and updated. And there is a building committee that's been appointed. In January, we'll have a meeting to put an RFP out for what's called an owner's project manager, which is called an OPM. Mm-hmm. Any building by state law that's over $1.5 million, which might, today, that number seems so low, doesn't it? I mean, that was a procurement law from 20 years ago that definitely needs to be upgraded now that I'm thinking about it. But anything over $1.5 million is required to have a licensed architect on staff that essentially takes over the project. Tri-County right now is you know, going through all that. They've hired an OPM to deal with the school up there. So, you know, I would say over the next 2 years, we'll be looking at defining the future needs of the town for 40, 50 years, laying out designs, hiring an OPM, and the OPM really leads the community generally with Mike, but really the OPM leads the community through the process of finding a site, what the design's gonna be, what's the community priorities. And so this $50 million number is just a...
A holding place.
It's just a holding place.
Got it. Okay.
Grant histories? You can just skim over them a bit.
Sure. Heather had asked for a dive into grants. We've published a couple of reports in there. And you know, as you can see over the course of time, you'll see in the last 2 years, the numbers have been larger than normal. And that represents a lot of the federal stimulus money, which was considered grants. And then we tried to add in there more details by fiscal year. And you can see a lot of the smaller grants, moderate sized grants the town gets. You know, we're generally recognized pretty highly for our grant acquisition. And just so people have a quick background, department heads run their departments, and they are the ones who are knowledgeable and who do grants. We get asked this all the time, why don't we have a grants administrator? Our view is that's generally a waste of money, because then to centralize one person for 20 departments, then one person then somehow has to have the knowledge of all the fire grants, all the police grants, all the facilities grants, the green communities grants, the planning grants, and we'll just let the planners apply for the planning, fire applies for fire, police apply for police. Senior Center is our latest heroes on grants. Danielle's been here for just about 2 years, and she's her and her staff have been getting a lot of smaller grants of $5,000, $10,000 to do tech improvements. They're buying new laptops for seniors to have a new smaller computer lab. Just small things like that that go a long way. You know, and some of the larger ones that the community is aware of, if you drive up and down Grove Street right now, that was a $3.5 million grant. We got to rebuild Grove Street through a program called MassWorks. Which is one of the most popular grant programs because it pays for public infrastructure. You know, Brutus and myself strategized that for 2 years with the town engineer. We hired a consultant, somebody that both Amy and I are very familiar with, April Anderson, who created those programs. We had her get in there to help us get that after a couple of years. So we spend a lot of time. We spend strategic time. Not every grant is worth chasing because when we apply for a lot of grants and then we don't get them, now we're wasting time and energy. So you know, departments do a really good job managing all that. Felicia does a great job. Schools get a ton of grants, as you can see here from the lists. And you can just kind of go through, and happy to answer any questions to the best of my ability.
Just one quick question. You consider Chapter 90 a grant?
It's considered by the state a grant.
Is it?
comes in the form of a grant, which is honestly, just so you know, is really just an accounting thing.
Okay.
Okay. It's a formula grant.
Do we
literally call it? It's a formula grant. Chapter 70 technically
is a grant?
Formula grant. No, well, that was like, come on. It just skewed. It just pads the stats way out of.
I understand, but you would theoretically consider it a grant.
Yeah, the state considers Chapter 90 a grant, and the state and the federal government considered ARPA funds a grant. So, I think it's just a lot of accounting. I know people don't think of it as a grant, like they don't like the MBTA Quiet Zone study is a grant, right? The shared streets and spaces was a grant. Housing choice was a grant. That was something we applied for, which is more traditionally, I think, Mike, what you're referencing. But we get these reports from the finance folks, and you know, it is what it is. So.
Anything else, guys, on any?
Heather, do you have any questions on grants?
Preceding?
I guess. And I'm sorry, I've been away all week. I'm not even in Franklin, right? So I haven't had a chance to really dive into this. I will, though. So you just mentioned, and just really quick, that you said that the school grants are on the same, is it on a different page than the fiscal year?
It is. There's a different report and a different link. It's labeled out 10-year, 10-year school, 10-year town.
Okay, thank you for that. And then I guess, and I'm sorry because I was a few minutes late as well, if you discussed this already, but with the new supplemental budget being approved by the state, I understood there to be a lot more grants coming down the pipeline for municipalities. Some of them, in fact, I have to do with school and building infrastructures. So I was wondering if anybody is thinking about that at all yet, or just not, maybe just too busy to think about that still, or like how that might come into play for Franklin?
That's a great question. So there have been a lot of federal authorizations. There's been a lot of state authorizations recently. Generally what happens, like in a budget, if there's a grant program that's authorized by the legislature, and I think the schools are the same, you know, eventually the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, or the Department of Fire Services, or the Executive Office of Elder Affairs, a state agency, right, would then, the grant money's not immediately available. They have to, like, sometimes if it's new, particularly like what we've seen recently, the bureaucracy has to like figure out a whole program on what's the criteria for a grant, what's the application process, what bureaucrat's going to oversee the selection criteria of it. And so when we get the press release that the grant is authorized, what we do as a staff is we're on all sorts of email lists relative to our topic area. Green communities, I'll just use as an example. Our facility staff, as well as myself, get every email, and they'll announce the grant, right? Like, okay, this is out there for solar panels. And then usually, like in Mike's case, we may work together to talk about that grant application. A lot of times, too, state agencies, if they're really good, they'll reach out to us and say, hey, you'll be really competitive for this. And also, a lot of times, Brutus is a good example of this. They'll try to get in touch with the federal government and ask them, will we be competitive for this grant program? A lot of federal grants right now are not competitive for us because, unfortunately, a lot of those grant programs are much more tailored towards more denser areas, or they have other criteria that don't fit the town of Franklin, for example, right? We don't have any pools, for example, so we can't apply for grants relative to rehabbing public pools, right? Obviously, Cambridge, Boston, some of they're going to get all that money. And so we try to look at it, Heather, you know, on a case-by-case basis to the best of our ability. I would note that, like, one grant on here, too, another dynamic, we got a Complete Streets grant, which the council finally passed a Complete Streets policy 2 years ago. We applied right away to get our first grant. I think it was $70,000 and some change, but it was to deal with infrastructure somewhat on Grove Street, on pedestrian crossings at the SNET Trail. and we hit some major snags with the design of that road, and so that grant money has continued on. Sometimes it takes us 2 years to spend. We also ordered recently the bike racks to be installed on the Common and at the train station, and it's taken 11 months for us to get bike racks because we're stuck behind. So that, Heather, is a unique dynamic to the time right now. You know, hopefully when all this, you know, these supply chain global problems go away, we'll just be able to, you know, order it up like Amazon 2-day Prime and just get it delivered. The traffic light on Grove Street, I think if you've been watching meetings, took 2 years to get here. Before the pandemic, we just go pick one up at Walmart and go install it, you know. So there's a lot of those dynamics in there. And so the staff are, to your point, messaging and trying to, so when you said we just don't have enough time, part of that is true, you know, because we're still managing grants we got money from 2 years ago, as well as other projects. The Quiet Zone study has taken forever because we couldn't hire and find an engineer to do it. Because engineers are really busy right now. They're completely overwhelmed with work. So sometimes when we can't get grants, we just are like, well, there's no vendors out there. We're not even going to apply. We know we're not going to be able to do this. So it's just a little snapshot into the staff background of how we approach grants.
Yeah, thank you, Jamie. This is, again, another key point, I think, when we're talking to the community about the budget and the budget process, and particularly, you know, we come up in May and we're at the 14th hour or whatever, and it's good to have some of this background, I think, on record to say, no, we do get emails every day and we do look into what's applicable to Franklin, and we are taking advantage of this, that, and the other. So it's good marketing just to have it in on record, I think.
Thank you, Heather. And we do a lot of lobbying with our lawmakers. We get, you know, appropriations and earmarks, and the schools get earmarks too, and, you know, on a variety of things to try to help all offset, you know, the cost to the taxpayer locally. So I appreciate that very much.
Okay, anything else, guys? We have some housekeeping. Oh, the general stabilization, do you have any comments, questions? Stabilization funds in general? Anybody? Never mind. They're not slush funds. That's a long story.
George.
They get us our AAA bond rating, Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
that's
they
why they're there. It's about proper fiscal management to make sure the community is safe.
They have full transparency.
Standard & Poor's and Moody's have all written that in our decisions.
Let me give you a little back.
So that people don't think they're slush funds, because I'm sure someone on TV is.
My site, myself and Michael and Heather went to a meeting at the Senior Center, which is always kind of interesting. And that came up from a regular questioner.
Boy, I wonder who that was.
Yeah. Anyway, I believe, answered the question properly. Mr. Sherlock was there.
Well, next time you talk to that gentleman, give him the AAA bond rating score from Standard & Poor's and you can read it right there.
That was discussed.
Good. I appreciate that.
So many other things. I do pay attention to these.
You may have brought a slide about it.
We have two sets of minutes. I'll make a motion that both sets be approved as written.
Second.
It has to be a roll call vote. Nat?
Yes.
I guess it was here. Heather?
Yes.
Shona?
Yes.
Mike?
Yes.
Lauren?
Yes.
5-0. With that, unless there's anything else,
six.
Consider this meeting. Oops, just.
Did you say 5? Because I think you got 4 there, 2 remote. That's 6.
Yeah, 6. I'm sorry.
And do you say yes?
6-0. Yes, and I didn't vote.
That's why it's 5.
Yes. All set. Anybody else?
Nope.
Mr. Jen. So. We have to do a roll call.
We do, yep. Sorry.
I say yes. Nat?
Yes.
Ella?
Yes.
Jonna?
Yes.
Mike?
Yes.
Lauren?
Yes.
We're adjourned. 6-0.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.